In recent writings, I've argued that at least at present, the functionalist program, which I started, yes, is empty. Empty because the notion of a computational description of meaning presupposes that we have at least an idea of what a possible form for such a description might be. Lacking such a description, even the notion of a computational state becomes a we know not what. Moreover, the fact that the interpretations of our propositional attitudes depend on environment, on context, and on the shape of our conceptual system as a whole, that meaning is holistic in more than one sense, suggests that the identification of any particular propositional attitude, say, the propositional attitude of believing that there are churches in Vienna, that's an example we'll be using a lot later in these lectures, identifying, understanding the meaning of, or having the capacity to think the thought that there are churches in Vienna, with anything as rigid as a fixed program, is unrealistic. In the case of the proposal that the scientific faculty is itself modularized and that our scientific competence can be completely recursively described, the situation is even worse than in the case of my former functionalist proposals. In the case of my own proposals, there was at least no contradiction in the idea that we might someday give content to talk of the computational description of the states in question. If a proposal that we do not know how to cash out, do not know how to take even a first step to investigating the proposal, and that's what I claim the proposal that propositional attitudes are computational states was, is a mere we know not what, then what are we to say about a proposal that we know could never be cashed out? The notion of recursive description of our scientific faculty is totally vacuous. What my Gödelian argument shows is that there's at least one concept which we are able to acquire, but such that it isn't the case that there's some describable module, some describable computational widget, whose structure, whose innate grammar, so to speak, completely captures our competence in the use of that notion. In short, either something is wrong with the modularity hypothesis, or something is wrong with the notion of competence. But none of this goes against the thought that there may be significant universal generalizations to be made about how human speakers do and do not employ the notions of demonstration and justification. This illustrates the way in which inferences from the existence of linguistic universals to the existence of mental organs are fallacious. But let us close by reflecting on this example. How might Chomsky evade the argument just given? What follows are some reflections triggered by this question. One, rejecting the competence-performance distinction and saying that what's at stake is the existence of a module responsible for our performance and not the description of our competence would short-circuit my Gödelian argument. But this is not a real option for Chomsky or for modern linguistics itself, for that matter. From syntactic structures onward, the arguments for the existence of linguistic universals have presupposed that the competence-performance distinction is in place, as have the later arguments for modularity. To appreciate why this is so, it suffices to employ Wittgenstein's discussion of following as simple an arithmetical rule as keep adding 2 to the number you are given to start with. If we were not allowed to prescind from performance errors, if the very notion of a performance error were not allowed, then we couldn't even say that what the speaker does when given the number 11 is to produce the sequence 13, 15, 17, dot, dot, dot. For that is not what the speaker, quotes, does if every slip of the tongue, every response produced by fatigue, every failure to remember the preceding digits correctly, etc., is taken to be part of the output we are asked to account for. Indeed, no module smaller than the whole grain, or better, the whole speaker plus the environment, can predict the whole of the speaker's output, warts and all. When we postulate a simple process under an idealized description, according to which What the process does is errorlessly perform the calculation given n, output n plus 2. This is what Wittgenstein calls using the machine as symbol, as opposed to thinking of the machine as an engineer does. When we think of an idealized machine as the process responsible for producing the series, we have already decided to discount any occasion on which the speaker says that it might be 222634 plus 2 equals 22636 as a performance error. The speaker has made the mistake of dropping one of the initial twos. The whole structure of linguistic theory and cognitive science presupposes that the competence-performance distinction is in place. Two, a better line of argument against the relevance of Gödelian considerations would be to insist on the distinction between linguistic competence and scientific competence and jettison the claim that the idea of a recursive characterization of scientific competence, which after all is a utopian idea of Chomsky's that few, if any, other thinkers would accept. Indeed, at a first blush, this seems to do the trick. For we can then say that to know the meaning of the word demonstrate, it's not necessary. You don't have to be able to follow complex proofs. You don't have to possess, in other words, mathematical competence. Somebody who can follow only the very simplest arithmetical or logical or geometrical arguments can easily show that he understands the word demonstrate. If what is included in our grasp of the literal meaning of the word demonstrate is limited enough, no Gödelian argument can get started. For Gödelian arguments presuppose an understanding of metalogical reasoning, mathematical induction, and so on. The Gödelian argument I referred to does indeed explode the claim that there's a recursively surveyable scientific faculty, but why should the linguist on the street follow Chomsky in that bit of metaphysical speculation? But now a different problem arises. The very fact that I just suggested we exploit to avert the threat of Gödelian arguments, and as I say, there are arguments which, however strange it may be to introduce them into a lecture on linguistics and the mind, are nevertheless perfectly appropriate when you make the notion of competence as utopian, as Chomsky does. The fact that we require very little of speakers when it is just a question of knowing the literal meaning of the word demonstrate and not of exhibiting some idealized competence at demonstrating mathematical truths. However, that fact cannot realistically be separated from such other by now familiar facts, which, as I say, we will talk about in later lectures, as the fact that no one fixed set of skills, no fixed set of linguistic skills and of non-linguistic skills interwoven with them is required before we can say that a speaker knows the meaning of the word demonstrate or indeed of any word. Moreover, even if a speaker exhibits a lot of skill at using the word, some further bit of corpus may reveal he doesn't, after all, have the concept we thought he had. If a speaker one day refuses to call something a demonstration because the Dalai Lama does not approve of it, we might have to revise our whole account of the meaning of this lexical item in his idiolect. This is, of course, the notorious problem of meaning holism. But I do not wish to end on a downbeat note. It would be bad to end my first Gavin David Young lecture on a downbeat note. Nothing in what I've been saying goes against the claim that there are linguistic universals, even at the level of semantics, as I said, at least in a weak sense, or that there are cognitive universals. Our cognitive competences are open textured and, as a rule, not recursively surveyable. But of course they're dependent on the sort of organism we are. That is why it makes sense to retain the idea of looking for linguistic universals, even if we must jettison the idea of a set of parameters or a language of thought or whatever, hidden invisibly behind and, quote, explaining each and every one of the universals we succeed in finding. What then is the right response to Diane Brentari's remark that what makes linguistics interesting is that we are finding out something about the human mind? Well, of course you are. In the sense in which any social science, in the sense in which all of history, in the sense in which every human achievement and every human disaster teaches more about the nature of our minds, or better, about human nature, period. But not in the science fiction sense, for that is what I claim it to be, that goes with the utopian programs I've been criticizing. Thank you.
Among the questions that Professor Putnam was asked was one about the relationship between language and animal noises, and what we can learn from animals.
My oldest friends, from my very first year of teaching in 1953, is a man called Alan Gardner, who, with his wife Trixie, brought up Washoe. And of course, when they started teaching Washoe language, they were absolutely vilified by the Chomskyans. I mean, there was a campaign. First of all, there was a smear campaign. There was an attack on the rigor of their methods. Just about everything they claimed was subsequently verified using additional controls, in some cases crazily elaborate controls, no matter how you restricted how the conditions under which the chimpanzee was observed. And in fact, some of those, the gardeners very carefully avoided publishing what was purely anecdotal, although the anecdotes I got from them were amazing. For example, Al, like most professors, and especially when he became famous because of Washoe, was always going away on an airplane someplace, like your vice chancellor. And one day, when a plane was flying overhead, Washoe pointed to the airplane and said, "Signed, you, me, go bye-bye." After the data themselves could not be overturned, that the Chomskyan simply redefined language so that Washoe didn't have language, in the process so that a two-year-old human doesn't have language. Although earlier, they had in fact used a different definition of language and insisted that two-year-olds, two-and-a-half-year-olds, and so on do have language. There is no doubt that chimpanzees fail to keep up with humans beyond, say, two and a half or so, to the disappointment of the gardeners and others. But they certainly have the line between animals possessing language and animals lacking language will never again, I think, be a sharp line. In that sense, we have learned something. Interestingly, an unexpected offshoot of that is that when you teach a chimpanzee to sign, you change its mentation. The performance of signing chimpanzees on tasks which do not involve language at all is much higher than chimpanzees who've never been introduced into this Pandora's box of symbolization in a language. And with respect to the significance of the girdle thing, which is obviously tremendously debated. The fact that Penrose could publish two bestsellers, exploiting in a way that every professional mathematical logician regards as fallacious. I don't care if he is the Roose Ball professor of mathematics at the University of Cambridge. When I negatively reviewed his books, I was speaking for the whole logical community. We know that that argument was a fallacy, but there's clearly a lot of excitement there. And indeed, Girdle did do something very remarkable. I mean, as someone said, the only thing more remarkable than the fact that there are truths of mathematics that you cannot prove even using these marvelous axioms that the great geniuses of 19th and early 20th century mathematics like David Hilbert produced is the fact that the human mind could know such a fact. And we did learn something both about our aspirations, our powers, and our limits from the girdle theorem.
Another question was on how diminished experience could be reconciled with innateness.
The brain, of course, has a complex developmental history. And one of the things that Jerry Adelman has stressed is growing out of his Nobel Prize winning work in biology is that, first of all, the number of brain cells that come into existence, at least briefly, is far, far greater by orders of magnitude to the number of brain cells you will have as an adult. There's a selection, a competition to survive among the brain cells. This is the reason, just to summarize briefly Edelman's chief data on what's called neurodarwinism. First of all, because which brain cells you have as an adult is the result of an unpredictable struggle for existence, identical twins do not have the same brain cells. Secondly, there is no complete wiring diagram of the brain in the DNA. The greatest amount of information is that the DNA code is capable of encoding. It's again smaller by orders of magnitude than what it would take for a complete wiring diagram of the brain. The brain, like Australia, has to develop historically and contingently. Again, another reason why even identical twins or clones, or if they come to be human clones, will not have identical brains. Thirdly, as on the sort of modified, Edelman doesn't like to be called a connectionist, he likes Bashir connectionism, but the differences are still fine. I mean, they have to do with degrees of biological realism, but I would say in a broad sense, he is a connectionist. And in connectionist models, supported by direct neurophysiological data from implanting microelectrodes in the brain, what happens as you learn, say, to recognize patterns, we know very little about the operations of the brain beyond vision and pattern recognition. But as you learn to recognize patterns, groups of cell assemblies are recruited. This is something first conjectured by Head in a famous book called The Organization of Behavior, I think back in 1960 or earlier. But groups of cells are recruited. Little computers are generated in the brain. They're not born. The ability to form them is inborn. But there's this very plastic architecture which allows modules to be formed by experience. This is what the Chomskyans don't like. And there's a constant trading back and forth of neurons between these modules. A module that is not used very much will lose neurons to other modules. If you don't very often touch things with the back of your hand, modules which are originally, say, sensitive to stimulation on the back of the hand will join the group that picks up stimulation from the front of the hand. So don't knock what history and contingency can do. I mean, these arguments, it must be innate, you know, supported. This reminds me of medieval reason in the bad sense. I mean, there's a lot of medieval reasoning that I like, but this is superstition, I think.